say so. He's 130 years old. Look at verse 8. Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? Kind of an interesting question
for a Pharaoh to ask someone, don't you think? So Jacob said to Pharaoh, the years of my sojourning are 130. Now, does anybody know how long Jacob lived? Yeah, that's right, 147. So he's going to be in Egypt for another 17 years, but to this point, at age 130, here's his assessment. I mean, he has just asked, how many years have you lived? But then he goes on to characterize those years as follows. Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life, nor have they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning. I don't want to get down in the weeds on this text because it's not the text we're actually supposed to study. Now, I can understand what he means when he says few have been the years of my life, not relative to anything we experience now, obviously. But Abraham lived to 175. Isaac, even longer, to the age of 180. Here's Jacob at 130, maybe sensing he doesn't have that many years left. What's the overall tenor of his, of how he characterizes his life? You don't have to be creative here. You can just draw upon the text. That his days have been evil. They've been, in this translation, says few and unpleasant. Anybody have a different rendering?
Evil.
Okay. So as he looks back on balance at his life, he sees a life that has experienced its share of trouble, has experienced its share of struggle. And I got to tell you, as I think about that, I have to believe that some of that has to do with the period we're going to study tonight. In Genesis chapter 29, Jacob has just left the protective confines of his father's house, in part because those confines are now no longer so protective and conducive to his well-being. Esau has said openly to anyone who will listen, I'm going to kill him. So he's sent away for his safety. He's also sent away with purpose. Isaac will instruct him to go and find a wife among his relatives. And so he's, however old he is here, he's a much, much younger man. Maybe, you know, he's open maybe to some adventure. He's at the end of our text in 28. He has this dream about the ladder. God appears to him in the dream, and in amazement, he names the place Bethel or Bethel. And so he's beginning to come to terms with this God who identifies as the God of his grandfather Abraham, and the God of his father Isaac. So in 29:1, Jacob is a younger man and he's on his way. And early in our text tonight, we'll see that he meets Rachel and then begins his servitude to Laban for all of those years. We see him as a man who is in love. We see him as a man who is beginning to have a family. By the end of our segment tonight in chapters 35 and 36, what changes? So let's kind of look at a before and after. What changes would you see in Jacob in any respect? In fact, let me do you a solid here. I'm just going to put the headings for our section up here. Just going to put them all up here at once. And it's the only slide I have tonight, so then I'll be done with this. So So Jacob's going to serve Laban for his daughters. And if you've read this text at all, you know how much time is involved with that. Okay, Jacob's children begin to be born. And boy, there's all kinds of juicy stuff going on there with the wives and the concubines and the maids that are given, this competition, this rivalry between the wives. Jacob's going to prosper while in service to Laban. He will leverage, and certainly with God's hand in it, but leverages whatever understanding he has about breeding livestock, and does so in a manner that would make Gregor Mendel envious, and thus becomes a very wealthy man. He'll leave for Canaan, kind of in the, he'll leave very secretly. He's going to have to, though, face up to his past, and there's a lengthy description of the fear that he has of Esau, the measures that he takes to try to safeguard what God has given him. Then all kinds of things begin to go wrong. He has a daughter who is raped, two sons that conceive to respond to that on a very violent and deceptive way, destroying an entire city. God then will appear to Jacob again at Bethel. So some interesting set of bookends here. In chapter 28, he names the place Bethel. It's where he has the dream of the ladder. And then here, God appears to him a second time at Bethel. Toward the end of our section, a lot of sadness, some tragedy, the deaths of Rachel, and of course his father Isaac. One is expected, and one probably not expected. And then the section closes with a separate toledoth about the descendants of Esau. So my question was, what changes do you see in Jacob from the beginning of all of this till the end of all of this? And we have a couple of brothers with mics back here. We'll apply it. Jim, after you're gone, I'm still going to call it the Whidden rule. If you have more than a sentence, use the mic. Sister Trish.
The honeymoon's over, you know, because he got mad.
Yeah.
He was angry with her. And it kind of makes sense, the things that happened with his father-in-law and different things along in these chapters. I can almost understand why he said, my time on this earth has been evil and not amounted to much, because he did have some problems and some troubles.
Right. So to put that in terms of something that has changed in his life, would it be fair to say he now understands the sting of deception firsthand? He's had it done to him now. Scott?
Well, I was just going to say, for someone who's named Supplanter, I mean, who was a deceiver, I do think you see maturity through all of this. And what I mean by that is to say, in his younger days, he's the one being the deceiver. And then as he's going through all of these things, it's story after story of people deceiving him. And yet what he does is have a greater reliance on God, that God is going to make it right.
Right.
And I think that that's maturity. Not that he's perfect or, you know, that he attained to perfection, but I just think you see just the maturing of Jacob through that.
Yeah, the unpleasantness of his years have served to refine him. God is now no longer just the God of his father. He's his God. That's right. He has to, it pushes him to greater reliance on God. What other changes do you see, Drew, over here?
Well,
By the way, Drew, really loved your talk Sunday night. I can't get that expression out of my mind. Who will be the snake crusher? If you didn't hear that, go back and listen to it. Go ahead.
So maybe when he first is the deceiver, there's a foundational lack of trust that God is going to bless him and make good on some of those promises to him, so he feels like he has to take it for himself, and there's a lack of trust in God. When he reunites with Esau right before then, he has a prayer in chapter 32, verses 9 through 12, that really highlights the shift from him trying to save himself to being completely dependent on God. And you see where he says, I'm not deserving of any of these blessings, but you did this to, you know, you have given them to me, and I'm afraid that Esau is going to kill me. And I don't see how that's going to square up when you've promised that I'm going to have a bunch of offspring, so please just deliver me. Yeah. And there's a total reliance in his heart posture that has changed.
Yeah, yeah. A wonderful prayer bookended by basically reciting to God what, I mean, God's fully aware of what he said to Jacob. And yet it was needful for Jacob to pray that lesson for us so that we run those thoughts through our minds. In the middle of it is utter humility. I am unworthy of all of this goodness. So as he looks back and thinks, well, it's been unpleasant, that obviously is not in any way disparaging the good hand of God who's been upon him. He's thankful for the blessings he received, but boy, they have come at a cost. There has been no small amount of turmoil that also perhaps has served to bless him in different ways. Okay, so physically, how would you, other than being older, Jacob carries with him, he has certainly literally not come away untouched by these years. What happens shortly after the prayer Drew references? What does Jacob, who does he encounter, and what is the physical outcome for Jacob following his prayer in 32? He wrestles with God. I think probably an angel as the representative of God. What does the angel do to Jacob? Such an odd thing. Yeah, he the socket of Jacob's thigh is dislocated. He touched the socket of his thigh. So he, that's all it says. So Jacob comes out of this with a very noticeable limp that the text comments on. He was limping on his thigh, verse 31, okay? And that'll be something that will affect the sons of Israel going forward. Somebody else had a comment. I didn't quite hear what was said. Okay. All right, any other changes to Jacob that you can think about? He's been brought low. He's grown in his faith, which those two things have to go together. We have to go low before the Lord can lift us up. Physically, he's older, but physically, I mean, he is literally not untouched by these years. Anything else you can think of? Sorry? Oh, yeah. Yeah, his name change. Oh, yeah, there's that. For the second time. Jacob, yeah, because when God appears to him in 28, verse 28, your name shall no longer be Jacob. Is that the first time that said? I know later when God appears to him, he says it again.
Again,
35, okay. So 28 and 35, are those the only two places that God says it? 35:10, your name is Jacob. You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. Scott has mentioned that the name Jacob means supplanter. Probably a play on words that has to do with the word heel. Remember, what was Jacob holding on to? Esau's heel. So it also just may carry this idea of somebody who follows behind as if to trip someone up. That was a fitting name for Jacob, and as was pointed out, he's going to experience some of that himself. What does the name Israel mean? Did you look that up?
Strive.
That's one word. Struggles with God. Is that what? Somebody said it over here. I have one who strives with God, or one who wrestles with God. Now, if I could ask you to put on your looking at this through the eyes of Israel lens, this man's namesake is going to be this nation. You want to talk about a history of striving with God, wrestling with God? Boy, doesn't that fit the children of Israel. It's this whole idea. I mean, Israel is going to have to, they're going to struggle with what the things that God tells them to do on a regular basis. They're going to struggle with the influences around them that would draw them away from their covenant maker. They're going to be constantly pushing back at the will and word of God. So it's really kind of a fitting name. Okay, anything else about just before and after Trish?
Over in chapter 32, when he becomes fearful of Esau, it seems like his faith dips a little bit because he comes up with this scheme to divide everything into two so that if one half gets destroyed by Esau and his men, they'll still have one half left.
Right.
That maybe he wasn't trusting God to take care of that, just like his mother wasn't trusting God to fix things so that Jacob became the preeminent one.
Right.
So he kind of takes after his mother.
Right. Well, it's the ongoing struggle we all have as to, you know, what does trusting in God look like? What do we do? Or, well, it's a daily decision. That's right. It's a daily decision. And we make judgments about what that's going to look like with a prayer on our lips, hopefully. Okay? Well, let's go back through and touch on a thing or two from these different episodes in our section here. Jacob serves Laban for his daughters. I suspect a narrative that many here are familiar with, but to just hit the highlights, Jacob, having been instructed to go to Paddan Aram to find a wife from among his relatives, he does so and encounters some shepherds in chapter 29. And verse 2 notes that the stone on the mouth of the well was large. He encounters some people there, begins to inquire where they're from. He learns that they are relatives of his. He asks, is it well with, he asks them, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? That's his point of contact. They said, we know him. And he said to them, is it well with him? And they said, it is well. And here is Rachel, his daughter, coming with the sheep. And so when Rachel comes, Jacob, of course, is smitten immediately. I found it interesting. I'm still contemplating this. If anybody has any remarks about this, it's interesting. It says that he goes up and rolls the stone from the mouth of the well. And waters the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. I don't know that that would necessarily serve as a glimpse of Christ at all, but at least some common themes there that could just be coincidental. We're introduced in this chapter, of course, to the two daughters of Laban. We're given some insight into how they appeared in verses 16 and 17, and thus we're essentially informed as to what it was about Rachel that Jacob found so attractive. Jacob is attracted to Rachel based on her appearance. Laban has two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. It says Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful of form and face. Now Jacob loved Rachel, and he proposes to serve 7 years, to spend 7 years in service to Laban for the privilege of getting to marry his younger daughter, Rachel. So initially, this it's all well and good. They strike this agreement. He spends the 7 years in verse 20. And anybody who's ever been in love can appreciate the language of verse 20. And they seem to him but a few days because of his love for her. Well, then in verse 21, the time has expired. He wants to marry Rachel. And of course, Laban deceives him. I don't know exactly how he pulls this off, but in the cover of night, he sneaks Leah in to the bridal chamber. And when Jacob wakes up in the morning, he realizes all too late he has consummated a marriage with Leah. In fact, the text says in verse 25, "So it came about in the morning," the word "behold" in Scripture means, it's almost like the text is stopping you, putting you in the action, okay? And it's almost encouraging you to see this with fresh eyes as the people there did. "Behold, it was Leah." What a surprise that was. And we've discussed before, this had been quite a while back, there's a great story here to think about with Leah. Multiple references are going to be made to the fact that Jacob does not love her. From the very first day he sets eyes on her, she is a disappointment to him. And we see God's compassion shown for her throughout the course of the rest of the book of Genesis. Leah will be honored toward the end of the book of Genesis. That's a great story. Any new insights or reactions that you have to this episode? We don't have time to really drink deeply of this, but Jacob here, this would be the first instance of being tricked, of experiencing the sting of deceit. I mean, he's going to go on and agree to serve 7 more years for Rachel. He will do that, but all along the way, as he will allude to later, what kind of an employer is Laban?
Deceitful.
He's deceitful. How many times has he end up changing his wages unannounced? 10 times. We're not told every time that happens. We just know later it has happened a lot. So there's a lot of disappointment. There's a lot of deceiving. He has come to not trust anything Laban says. And this, what happens here, was the first big instance of that. But any other thoughts about this section before we move on? Okay. Can you appreciate, you don't have to answer out loud, can you appreciate how this episode would begin to refine Jacob? Can you see how this episode would begin to push Jacob closer to God? How far away? Anybody happen to look to see how far away Haran was from Beersheba? I mean, I did my little nerdy thing and got out my ruler and tried to figure out how many tick marks 50 miles was per my map. And then as the I don't think the crow would fly this far, but as the crow flies, it seemed like it was about 500 miles. But there are actually roads that go from point A to point B. So you actually map it, and driving it says it was like 650 miles. That's how far away he is from the protective confines of his father's tents. Who does he have there? He has his wives, although you could hardly blame Leah if there's a trust issue there. He has his wives, and that's it. It's him and God. So I want you to think about situations in your life and when you have felt alone and isolated, and maybe you don't think you're kind of in an Elijah mode. No one else cares. What do you do? And Jacob is going to endure. He's going to grow from this. All right? So then Jacob's children are born. You know, God has promised that your descendants will be like the sand on the seashore or like the stars of the sky. Well, the math needs to kind of pick up a little bit, eh? Abraham had two sons and God sent one of those away. There's only one son of promise. So if we're going to have descendants like the stars of the sky, eventually somebody's got to have some kids. And Jacob is going to have 12 sons. But how does that, I mean, I'm not talking biologically, how that comes about. Tell me about the circumstances that contribute to so many kids being born. A rivalry that, I mean, unlike any other. I know this is a separate subject, and I'm just going to offer a thought for your further study about that. There's a long period of time where God seemingly says very little to anything about polygamy. Multiple wives. But I will tell you, I'm not sure that there's any divine commentary that would expose the folly of that sort of lifestyle than a text like this. It's almost as if God sometimes just trusts us to be smart enough to look at something and to realize just how far short it falls of God's design and God's ideal. I would just offer that for your further consideration. It's a mess. It's a nightmare. It's almost like here's the sun scoreboard. Leah's up 4-0. And, it, you know, the bottom of the fifth or whatever. She has four sons. Can you name them? Do you want me to make you sing the song? Now, who's the first one? Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, okay? Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Well, at this point, we're into chapter 30. Rachel realizes she's not bearing Jacob any children, and so she resorts to,
Here's my maid.
Have we seen that before? Yeah. Is it right? No. Is God going to use it? Nonetheless, yes, he will. So Rachel gives Bilhah as her maid, as a wife to Jacob. Jacob has two more sons. They are so named Dan and Naphtali. I've heard it pronounced Naphtali. That sounds pretty cool. I don't know. But we don't, again, I'll just say, if Curtis's ears are buzzing later, Marianne. Curtis is very good at knowing how to pronounce all these names. I'm just guessing. And if you say it confidently, no one will ever know. So Dan and Naphtali. Okay? Well, in retort, because after Judah, what does the Lord do? Yeah, she stops bearing. So then she's like, two can play this game. She gives her maid, Zilpah, to Jacob, and Then he has two more sons. So now we're up to eight sons. Who are these two sons named? What are the names?
Gad and Asher.
Gad and Asher. So we have Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. Well, then Leah is able to conceive and bear children again, and she will have two more sons. They are named Issachar and Zebulun. Also has a daughter, Dinah, who we'll read about later. Well, then, in chapter 30 and verse 22, I think it is, a phrase that we've seen throughout. I believe God has compassion on both of these wives. Neither of them asked to be in this situation, by the way. They're in this situation because Laban acted deceitfully. You ever been stuck in a situation where there are seemingly no good choices because of something someone else did? If you ever have, these two ladies would like to have a word. They understand. And so it says, God remembered Rachel. I think he remembered Leah too. Had compassion on her. Well, then Rachel finally is able to bear a child. Bore a son. And of course, we know this son will be named Joseph and how significant he will be later on. And so notice the language. With all of these names, there is a commentary about the circumstances that is very much tied to the selection of the name. God has taken away my reproach. She named him Joseph, saying, may the Lord give me another son. And he will. But what will transpire when that son is born? She will die in childbirth. And that son, of course, will be Benjamin. That's later on in chapter 35. Go and look up the meanings of these names. I've got them written down here. I'm not going to go through that. But it's interesting, the meaning of these names as you think about Israel's history. But Naphtali, again, has this idea of wrestlings. With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed. Issachar, God has given me my wages. Okay. And Dinah, interestingly, means vindicated. Okay. Any other comments about the sons of Jacob? This is a very significant text in the history of the Old Testament. This time you're going to say that in the mic.
Okay, I said I've heard it called the great baby race.
Well, that's one word for it, one expression for it. Yeah, it was. They were keeping score with the number of children they could bear for their husband. Okay, so Jacob continues to serve Laban and prospers, even as his wages are being changed, as Laban is proving to be difficult to work for. In chapter 31, he calls Rachel and Leah, verse 4, to his flock in the field. So he's going to have a private meeting with his wives. I see your father's attitude, verse 5, that it is not friendly toward me as formerly, but the God of my father has been with me. I want you to see that, those last few words there. Even as this is all going down, Jacob's mind increasingly is becoming God-centered. And he sees maybe he sees that there's a bigger picture here, but he sees that God has been with me. By the way, can we look ahead and see something of that attitude? Where do you think Joseph learned how to rely on God when away from home and isolated? I mean, if he had to have learned it from Jacob. Because we're not done talking about rivalry in Jacob's family, not even close. I mean, this is going to be the gift that keeps on giving with these sons born to different women and the rivalries between them. And so this is a sentiment we're going to see essentially reflected later, another generation down the line. Okay, so Jacob is prospering. And then at some point, chapter 31, he decides we're leaving for Canaan. Now, he doesn't just do so on a whim. He's instructed to leave by God. I did not write down exactly what verse that was. 31:3. There it is. Thank you. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you." Now, in Jacob's words to his wives, he believes God has been with him. He also believes that God will be with him. And God indeed intervenes for him. He intervenes, speaks to Laban. They don't exactly have a very cordial final meeting, but they leave on friendly terms. They leave in peace. They make a covenant. And so God's purpose for this time in Jacob's life has been fulfilled. And now Jacob at this point is a father with 12 children, 11 sons and a daughter, on their way back to the land of Canaan. So he's gone from Bethel to Paddan Aram, which would be a north, if you were looking at it this way at the map, it's mostly north, but a little bit to the east, so kind of north-northeast. All 600, 700 miles, whatever it ends up being. Don't know the precisely exact route they took. Children are born to Jacob during these years. And we know some time has passed because it was later on the sons are old enough to take revenge on their... The youngest child, Dinah, is raped. So some time has passed here. So they leave for Canaan, but then along the way, Jacob's past catches up with him, and he is told, okay, Genesis 32, verse 6, the messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you." And what else are we told? 400 men. Does that fit what you know about Esau to this point? He's a man of action. He's a hunter. He's a man of bloodshed. And oh yeah, by the way, he is a man who has been on record saying, "I will do such and such to my brother." And so when Jacob hears this, naturally, he's very, very afraid. Very concerned. Esau is not a person to speak idly. When he bring 400 men, so here, can I just put a Bible study thought out there? I couldn't prove this either way. I mean, we know Jacob is going to pray for deliverance. Does God grant that? Yeah, absolutely. I believe Esau's heart changes as a product of prayer. I think the 400 men doesn't convey exactly a meet and greet intention. I think he's intent initially, again, I could not prove that. It's just when you read, you're contemplating like we all do. But this is powerful. This is powerful. Now, to the point made earlier, Jacob is going to divide up his possessions and his household into multiple camps. And let's see here. Is that in 32 or is that in 33?
32:7.
Okay. I keep going down further. Jacob was greatly afraid, distressed. He divided the people who were with him, the flocks, the herds, the camels, into two companies, which fits the meaning of the name Mahanaim. For he said, if Esau comes to the one and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. is thinking somewhat practically. I could imagine any of us might have thought so. Who does he put at the very, very back, furthest away from any trouble? What? Rachel and Joseph. And then in front of them, Leah and her sons. So once again, he's showing preference, you could argue. Well, of course, Esau and Jacob meet, and it is not anything close to what Jacob had feared. It is a wonderful reunion. It is an emotional reunion, and they are able to make peace with one another and with the past. And Jacob has really here sees the benefit of walking by faith. He has really had to walk by faith in chapter 32, at least in his praying, but his faith is still growing. And God indeed delivers him. And so Jacob continues on his way back, and he's going to make his way to the city of Shechem, where in chapter 34, as I mentioned, Dinah is raped. Who are the two sons of Jacob that respond in the violent manner? Simeon and Levi. Doesn't help Jacob standing in the land at all. When I study this, I mean, there's the retort that Simeon and Levi give to Jacob at the end of the chapter. Should he treat our sister as a harlot? What are you going to say to that? I mean, no, he shouldn't. But, of course, their actions make, what are Jacob's words here? Verse 30, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land. So more heartbreak and suffering for Jacob. Jacob again is going to be named Israel. He's journeying back to Bethel. Verse 7 of chapter 35, he builds an altar there. And then he journeys from Bethel in verse 16. I know we're just thumbing through this. When there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, And yes, we're later learned that's Bethlehem Ephrathah, the same Bethlehem. When there was still some distance to go, Rachel began to give birth, and she suffered severe labor. The midwife says to her, "Do not fear, for now you have another son." Remember what she said when Joseph was born? She was looking forward to God giving her another son. And he does, but Rachel dies in childbirth. She names the child Ben-Oni, or the son of my sorrow. But Jacob instead names him the son of the right hand. Probably a favor. How would you like to carry around the name son of my sorrow all your life? It was a blessing to Benjamin to be named something differently. But, I mean, after all that we've been told about the relationship Jacob and Rachel have and his feelings for, it just says succinctly, Rachel dies and is buried on the way to Bethlehem. He sets up a pillar over her grave. But then it says in verse 21, he journeys on. Now, quick question before we end. I know better than to ask Michael, but I'll ask anyway. Are they on their way in? Oh, all right. Here's the question for the start of class next week. Why is chapter 36 here in your Bible?